His Holiness the Dalai Lama has commented that he believes that our desire for happiness is what really distinguishes us as humans. And this is actually, as humans, our most primary drive is this drive to find genuine happiness. And so in our quest for genuine happiness, there are two questions that can be asked. And the one that we normally ask and that people in our culture ask is, what is it that I can do to be happy? What is it that I don't have right now? If I'm not happy right now, what is it that I'm missing and how do I go about getting it? And so the answer in our culture is consumerism, largely. You shop your way to happiness, you acquire your way to happiness, you relationship yourself your way to happiness, but there's something that's missing that you don't have, and you go out and find it. You make that your big mission in life is to find the missing parts, the missing elements, and then, you know, when you acquire them all, you have this big heap, and hopefully that heap adds up to happiness. And so that doesn't seem to be working very well, as the rates of depression and anxiety just keep increasing. As we consume more, you know, as every one of us becomes more and more affluent in our Western culture, and we have more and more so that we reach the point where we have to rent lots of mini storage to house everything that we own that we never even see, but we have a mental inventory of it all because we can't fit it in the limited square footage that we have in our houses now. So Dzogchen takes an entirely different approach to this question of what is it that I do to make me happy, or how is it that I go about fulfilling this primary drive of finding genuine happiness. And so rather than asking the question, what is it that I can do to find happiness, Dzogchen says, what is it that I can stop doing that is making me unhappy right now? And then I just discover the natural state of happiness that is there when I stop being unhappy. It's a really different approach. The basic assumption is that we have everything that we need already. That happiness, genuine happiness, everything that we can possibly even imagine as being ultimate happiness is there waiting for us, right there in our ordinary moment of perception. And all we have to do is stop doing what we're doing right now that is obscuring that natural state of happiness. So that is what we are going to be doing. And in our whole approach to meditation, this is exactly the approach that we take to figuring out this whole strategy and actually navigating the path to authentic happiness. We stop doing what it is that we're doing now that is preventing us from experiencing the ultimate happiness that we long for. So this Lama Allen, because he's a comparative scholar of religion at Stanford, he has lots of very interesting ways of analyzing and parsing out similarities and differences. Not only between religious or spiritual paths and approaches, but within Buddhism itself. So he's, you know, I really appreciate the nuance that he brings into his distinctions about similarities and differences among the various schools of Tibetan Buddhism. So one that is very, very helpful and germane to what we're doing this weekend is this difference between what he calls the path of development and the path of discovery. And so, or the approaches of development and discovery. And so in the approach of the Sakya and Gelugpa schools, this is the developmental approach, meaning that, and then the approach of Mahamudra Kagyu and Dzogchen Nyingma schools are the discovery approach. And the basic the real distinction in those two is the understanding of what Buddha nature is. And so in Dzogchen, it is not that when the ultimate happiness that we're going to discover with Dharmakaya, or when we become liberated and we actually achieve the bodies of a Buddha, it's not something that we develop that we don't have now. So in these developmental schools, the understanding of the emptiness of our minds, Buddha nature is the emptiness of our minds. And so this means that we have the potential to become a Buddha because our minds are empty. We are not inherently or intrinsically sentient beings. And this mind that I take to be so concretely mentally afflicted and suffering is actually just another empty conceptual designation. And because of its emptiness, we have the potential through practices like the six perfections and understanding and cultivating analytical meditations largely on emptiness, then we have the potential to develop something that we don't have right now. So that's the developmental approach. The discovery approach is that the three bodies of a Buddha or the four bodies of a Buddha are here right now in my ordinary moment of perception. So it's not something that you're lacking. It's something that you have right now that is obscured. And so the whole point of practice then is to unobscure what you have already there. And this is really one of the fascinating differences about this. And one of the exhilarating differences between these two approaches then is that if you already possess Buddha nature, if you already have pristine awareness, and it's not something that you have to develop because it's not there yet, then you can have glimpses of it right now. It's as if, like last night, what was happening? Thunder, lightning, you know, we weren't seeing the moon last night, I don't think, you know. But if we were outside looking up at the sky, what we probably would have seen, because the thunder and lightning stopped at some point and the heavy rain stopped. And so at that point then, the clouds parted and you probably would have seen the moon. And so then today we have beautiful blue sky, but maybe tomorrow again the clouds are going to form and, you know, obscure the sky. So we can have, and it may not be full days of your glimpse of pristine awareness, but there might be session or moments anyway within sessions. It could be an entire session where you just feel like this is it. I had people in the last retreat, you know, get to this point where they felt like, I think I was just resting in pristine awareness for a whole ghataka, you know, and what can you say? Try to figure out, and it sounds like, wow, that right on. You know, what can you say? And so this is the real important distinction, is that when you have these glimpses, then you take them not as some conceptual abstraction or as a facsimile, but you really saw the moon. You really saw the moon. That was it. So all you do then is you figure out, why am I not perceiving that all the time? Why is it that most of my experience is this conceptual abstraction of the world? And why is it that that leads to my experience of dissatisfaction and suffering? And you just reverse engineer it that way then. And then your whole path of Dharma becomes more like pulling rather than pushing. So the glimpses become like a magnetic attraction, and they just pull you through your whole path, and you're highly motivated because you've seen what there is there at the culmination of the path. And then the whole path, even once you cut through to pristine awareness, Dujom Lingpa points this out in his spiritual memoir of Mud and Feathers, that he was resting in pristine awareness for long periods of time, you know, not a facsimile, but the real thing. But then he would become mentally afflicted, and then he was just an ordinary sentient being. And so, you know, how is it that you just, even when you have, you reach pristine awareness, how is it that you continually develop a greater and greater stability? How is it that you really transform this into a stage development rather than a state of consciousness? So that's what the whole program of Dzogchen is about: uncovering, unobscuring, finding what is really there, and then making that your everyday routine experience. And all of this, what I just said, is not something that came from analysis and logic and doctrine. And it's not to be taken as belief and doctrine. And you don't raise your hand and swear allegiance to the Dzogchen path. You know, all of this is intended to be experienced. So this is exactly what Padmasambhava had in mind when he said that according to the custom of some teaching traditions, you are first introduced to the view, and on that basis, you seek the meditative state. So this is the developmental schools, or it's not exactly, that's not quite accurate, because even among the Kagyus, there is this approach of scholarship and scholasticism, of becoming a Lopan or a Kempo. And so this takes a long time. You go, you know, to school basically in the monastery for 20-some years, and it's a very rigorous education. And the point is that you develop the view first. You're educated in the view, and then hopefully at some point then some percentage of these very well-educated Kempos and Geshes actually go off and learn to meditate then. But according to people in the know, including Alan, that, you know, is a small percentage of all the people that actually get this extraordinary education actually then, like one of his great lamas, Geshe Robten, after getting the Geshe degree, then goes off and does 7 years of retreat, you know, and then puts it all together and has the realizations. So this is what Padmasambhava said: according to the custom of some teaching traditions, you are first introduced to the view, and on that basis, you seek the meditative state. And here's the caveat: this makes it difficult to identify pristine awareness. So, you know, this is a pretty bold statement, but this is a pretty bold teacher who is making that statement, you know, and you know, who's going to refute Padmasambhava? So taking that approach, he says, if you really try to just assimilate through teachings and through reading and scholarship the view, and then say at some point I'm going to, after my understanding is perfect, then I'm going to try to put it into practice. And, you know, then it will be easy, because really understanding is 9/10 of it, and then the rest of it is easy. Well, Padmasambhava says if you take that approach, all of the conceptualization actually becomes an impediment. He says this makes it difficult to identify pristine awareness. In this tradition, now he's talking about my, you know, Padmasambhava's tradition, my tradition. In this tradition, you first establish the meditative state. Then on that basis, you're introduced to the view. This profound point makes it impossible for you not to identify pristine awareness. Therefore, first settle your mind in its natural state. Then bring forth genuine shamatha in your mind stream and reveal the nature of pristine awareness. So this is what we want to do, is to put ourselves into a position in which it's impossible not to identify pristine awareness, rather than making it impossible to identify pristine awareness. So that's the whole approach that we are going to take. We're in this retreat. And this is really the whole Dzogchen approach, is that first we're going to learn to meditate, and then we are going to use our meditation while we are essentially resting in non-conceptuality, be introduced to the view, and then rest in that view. So, simple as that. So, in this approach then, in shamatha, what we achieve with shamatha is non-conceptuality, luminosity, and bliss. So these are the basic primary qualities of experience when you're resting in substrate consciousness. And this is what we are doing, because this is the discovery approach, is that we are simply discovering this essential state of the mind. And you could say it's the essential state of the relative mind. And so non-conceptuality, luminosity, and bliss. And this is not something that we create and discover, or create that isn't there now, but we simply discover what is there, this natural state of the relative mind, meaning it's still, well, wouldn't say configured, but it is not the end of the path yet. It's still a samsaric mind. But so then the whole path of shamatha is really figuring out what it is that is obscuring what is already there right now, the natural non-conceptuality, luminosity, and bliss, and then use the practices that are so well proven in to achieve the meditative states that Padmasambhava is talking about. So we can ask the question then, why is it that we aren't experiencing this natural state right now? What is it that is obscuring the natural state? And so here is a question for you. Would you say that the natural state of the mind would be so habituated to constant stimulation that it would prefer to administer an electric shock to itself rather than to sit quietly in the silence of the mind? So all of you have heard this research before, but that pretty much sums up the state of our contemporary situation and the mind that we are cultivating. So you can think, I think this is really true, and all of people of my age who have a broader perspective than you young people, a larger body of evidence to work with, because I can remember the first, or at least my first transistor radio. You know, I can remember all the heat that came off television sets and radios, you know, because there were tubes in them. I can remember, so if I can remember that far back, I can certainly remember the first ATM, and then more recently, I can remember the first cell phone. You know, even my memory goes as far back as 2006. And I didn't get an iPhone in 2006, but I started to hear about them then. And, you know, that was the revolution. There was in 2006, there was just this concatenation of extraordinary things that happened in the culture of technology that made, and they didn't really happen independently. So if you ever really are interested in the history of this, read Thomas Friedman's book, Thank You for Being Late. It's the description of what happened in technology in 2006 to make the iPhone possible. And it was a lot more than Steve Jobs, you know. And so there was just this concatenation of technological advances that happened simultaneously. And before that, there were no smartphones, because they weren't really possible. And so remember what it was like. So we're Now it's only 13 years ago. And to think. So there's nobody in this room that can't remember a time before the iPhone. And so we are, now that you can understand then, with that as a preface, you can understand the statement that we are running a worldwide human experiment on training our minds right now. And what the data that's coming in, the results that are coming in, have been pretty well, you know, trending in a consistent direction for a long time now. You know, so if it's been 13 years since the iPhone has been out, for probably 10 years of that, research and studies have been warning about the erosion of attention and everything that's beginning to happen in our relationship to the world and our state of happiness and our state of unhappiness. You know, so it's almost like global warming now. You know, at some point maybe there were some climate deniers and there were some multitaskers, believers in multitasking. But it's just really harder and harder and harder to find anybody that can truly justify those opinions anymore. So here we are having this in this worldwide experiment, and you know then at the University of Virginia in 2014, in this waiting room experiment, basically, just undergraduates, I believe they were probably undergraduates that were being researched, were just put in a sterile room, and the first study was just what was your experience of sitting in this room with nothing to do for 15 minutes? And the researchers were really surprised by the self-reporting of how uncomfortable that was and how restless, dissatisfied people were in 15 minutes. And you might think, you know, being an old geezer, I might think, that if you had a really busy life, you know, like an undergraduate, that having 15 minutes of doing nothing would be really welcome. And you would just chill out and think about sex or something. And be totally happy about that. But people were really dissatisfied. And so they wondered then, I wonder how dissatisfied, and would people actually, if given the choice of just thinking about sex for 15 minutes or administering an electric shock to themselves, would they actually choose the electric shock? And the bottom line, 67% of men and 25% of women actually chose the electric shock. So there you have it. That is the answer. So that is my answer to what is it that is obscuring the natural state of the mind. So if you have a mind that is so habituated to stimulation, you know, and I don't think there's anybody in this room that would mind 15 minutes sitting alone, you know, right? But we're outliers now. You know, there are more and more of us outliers all the time. But, you know, we're still a minority. And as, you know, the benefits of all of this become more and more well known, people are given the choice, you know, or they start to think, I wonder if really, I maybe should. There is another approach. But basically, it's this constant search and seeking of stimulation. And so that's one element. Constantly filling the silence that is obscuring the natural state. So if we can be content, actually, with silence, content when there is no stimulation, rather than filling it, just reveling in the experience of being present. Because is there nothing? Well, answer that, you know, after some sessions of meditation. Is there just an absolute voidness? No, you're never going to experience that except in deep dreamless sleep or unconsciousness. So the whole point of especially the first three common preliminaries that we just reviewed very briefly last night as a way of inspiring motivation for your retreat and thinking about your big goal in life and how that relates to this retreat. What that can lead to when you really have this zeal then and you begin to have some experience of the natural state of your mind and the body and speech, but you really begin to get glimpses of the moon, the clouds part. This can inspire Nyenjung, which is often translated as renunciation, but it's Alan translates as the spirit of emergence. And so what was the definition that we memorized? Renunciation is day and night working endlessly to get out of samsara, something like that. But basically, with renunciation, what you are, the whole point, or Nyenjung, is the spirit of emergence, is that you feel this disillusionment with what is, but it's not just that. And I think, you know, oftentimes there is this caricature of renunciation as that. But the French existentialists felt that also, nausea for the current situation, you know, and then because of the absurdity of our situation, suicide was a natural and heroic response to our absurd condition. And a lot of German realists also, a lot of philosophers. So philosophers in Europe in the 20th century, there was an epidemic of suicide because that was thought to be the authentic response to the absurdity of our condition. So disillusionment is not sufficient for Nyenjung, for this spirit of emergence. So that's one thing. You realize that you become dissatisfied with dissatisfaction, with the perpetual state of dissatisfaction. You say, there's got to be more than this. And so the second element is a path, a direction, an alternative to what you're doing right now. So when you have these two elements and the disillusionment that pushes you, you could say, and then the path that is pulling you, then you have real spirit of emergence and zeal that really propels you on the path. Then you travel the path with zeal, and you're obviously going to not only get there faster, but you're going to enjoy the process along the way, if you have this zeal, this enthusiasm, delight in practice, all of that. So when you're thinking about the disillusionment part, especially, so let's just say that the part that is attracting us, is pulling us, the alternative would be the natural state, these glimpses that you get of pristine awareness and of substrate consciousness. So this is the alternative. And so you have meditative experience, and then you incorporate that with the view. So this becomes the alternative to what you're doing. But what is it that you're actually becoming disillusioned with? Is it living on Cape Ann, or on the East Coast, or in the United States? You know, is that it? And that you have to leave this address where you're living? So is your address the address of samsara? You know, and that if you just get a new house or move somewhere else, or maybe it's not the house, maybe it's a relationship, maybe it's a new job, maybe it's the puppy, maybe it's a child, maybe it's getting rid of the child. The child grows up and leaves, you know, whatever. Is the circumstance that you find yourself in now, just the physical circumstances, is that samsara? There's a caricature, I think, in Buddhism that's it. And that samsara is life on this planet. Planet Earth is home of samsara. Wow, that seems perverse, doesn't it? You know, we may be turning it into hell, but that doesn't mean it's samsara. So what is samsara? It's really interesting to to try to get a grasp on this, because this is what we, if we don't understand what samsara is, how is it that we are going to leave it behind? And how are we going to recognize liberation, even if it is right there staring us in our face? Could it be that our present moment of experience is liberation already, but we think it's samsara because we don't really understand what samsara is? I mean, it's possible that we could be that confused. So, what is samsara? Gyatro Rinpoche, in his commentary, one of the things that I really love about this book, Spacious Path to Freedom. You know, this is, I feel like this is one of these books that if I was going to be marooned in a retreat cabin for the rest of my life, and I had only three books to bring with me, this would be one of them, right? So Spacious Path to Freedom would be one book. Lam Rim Chenmo, three volumes, would be the second book. And then the three volumes of Dujom Lingpa's Visions of the Great Perfection would probably be the third book. You have to think like that when you're headed to retreat, right? Because that, I think, would pretty well do it. But one of the things that I really like about, or that I really appreciate about Spacious Path to Freedom, is that unlike most of the other texts that Gyatro Rinpoche taught and Alan translated, you find in this book, you find the commentary of Gyatro Rinpoche along with Karma Chagme and this beautiful, as Alan calls it, a bouquet of all these Mahamudra masters. But you find in the commentary of Gyatro Rinpoche why Alan is so, you know, enthusiastic about his teachings, you know, because it's his commentary to some of these extraordinary Mahamudra citations is really, really contemporary, pithy, and, you know, and so here, for example, enlightenment is nothing other than the nature of your own mind. This is Gyatro Rinpoche. Do not look elsewhere. A mind imbued with conceptual elaboration is a mind of samsara. A mind free of conceptual elaboration is liberated. The very nature of the mind itself is primordially, intrinsically free from conceptual elaboration. Consequently, when we abide in that state, we are abiding in the essential nature of the mind. That is nirvana. So now you have a real working definition of what in this approach is samsara. It is a mind that is imbued with conceptual elaboration. And I think another, you know, if you were to add a footnote to that, you would, you might add that the conceptual elaboration of the world and your own mind and body and all of that, you take to be true. You take to be reality. And you confuse the conceptual elaboration with as being true rather than just being a dream. Because that's all the conceptual elaboration is a dream. And so it is that reification of the conceptual elaboration as being true that which is ignorance. So the samsaric mind is imbued with this conceptual elaboration, and it then mistakes. So this is what is delusion, that is the root of samsara, or that samsara depends on, is reification, this mistaken conceptual elaboration, my experience of not only what I take out there to be the world and external world, but also my experience of my own mind, my own body, the conceptual experience that I have of that, taking that to be true. And so this is, what is it that creates the mind and body of a sentient being? Conceptual elaboration. And so if you want to be a mind that transcends, So you want to eliminate the concept or the mind and body of a sentient being? You want to purify it? What do you do? Well, you reside in this state beyond conceptuality, in this primordial mind that is beyond conceptualization. And so we'll talk tomorrow. Again, about what I call the architecture of the mind, or what Dujom Lingpa, I think I might have called it this also, but how the world of things comes into existence. And then it really becomes clear about how the conceptual mind relates to substrate and substrate consciousness, and then pristine awareness. It becomes really clear. We've got a chart for it in the handout that describes that. But that basically is, so Nianjun is having the alternative to this dissatisfaction with dissatisfaction. And that is the natural state of the mind that is not imbued with conceptualization. So this is what, so if you were going to design a meditation practice then to get you to liberation, would it be based on conceptuality? Interesting thought, isn't it? This is the whole approach of the developmental schools is very, very conceptual. And frankly, Tantra, everything below Ati Yoga, is also extremely conceptual. You know, what you're doing is conceiving things in different ways than you normally do. And then by recognizing that you can conceive of things in different ways, that they are, of course, empty, because you can conceive of them differently. And that the conception actually creates the reality. But it still is really working with conceptuality, and the whole goal being that eventually you transcend conceptuality. But in this approach, this is Ati Yoga, the ninth yana. This is the highest approach. His Holiness, you know, refers to it as that also, the pinnacle of Tibetan Buddhism. This is beyond all of the other lower tantras. This is still within Vajrayana, but it is, you know, the highest of the Vajrayanas, practices of the yanas. And so Padmasambhava says, so here in this approach then, what we are going to be doing is working directly with an approach that in our meditative experience to lead us as quickly as possible beyond conceptualization. And that's what our whole, this is how we unobscure the natural state of the mind, is that we are going to try to, with our meditative practice, develop the skills and experience where we can rest in non-conceptualization and be content with it without shocking ourselves. So Padmasambhava said, first establish the meditative state, non-conceptual samadhi. So this is what we do. First of all, we establish that state. Then we're going to be introduced to the view, and then rest in the view. That's the whole program. So beginning with, how do we do that then? This meditative skills that lead to this non-conceptual state. So this is what shamatha, this is what this whole genre of practices is, which is called shamatha. And the Mahasiddha Maitripa, who is one of these great crossover figures from the world of yoga, of the Mahasiddhas of yoga, of Tantra, to Mahamudra, who also was an extraordinary figure in Mahamudra, is cited in, again, Spacious Path to Freedom. The Mahasiddha Maitripa states in his essential instructions, there are three types of shamatha. So wherever you see quiescence or serenity, depending on which text it was that Alan was translating at the time, he says basically now just substitute shamatha. You know, it's one of these things that translators go through. you know, at what point do you stop translating Sanskrit terms into what you hope are some sort of English equivalent? And he says, now we've, you know, like bodhicitta, do you really need to translate that as enlightenment mind? Does it mean the same, you know, does it connote the same thing to people? Now, these terms are so familiar to people now, and they now have received, people have received teachings on what these mean, and so to you have this whole body of connotation to know what the term means now. So we just use shamatha rather than quiescence or calm abiding now. So first of all, there are three types of shamatha. One, shamatha that depends on signs. Two, shamatha focused on conceptualization. And three, shamatha that is settled in non-conceptualization. So this is going to be the arc of our practice in developing shamatha. And frankly, the four modes of mindfulness supplies the real missing link here. I mean, it's just so brilliant, this. And it's hard to imagine that we were ever doing shamatha practice in another way. But so this is what we're really going to be focusing on, this arc. First of all, we're going to travel, go through all three of these approaches to shamatha. And the first is shamatha that is focused on science. So this is the approach that Dujom Lingpa advocated. So this is the most common approach to shamatha out there. And so this, in Natural Liberation, Dujom Lingpa text, he says in his description of shamatha practice, you start off with shamatha focused on science. And there he said, a stick or a stone. So, you know, candle flames are often used in the yoga traditions. You know, something, a sign. Sign means something material that you're focused, or something that you're focused on that is external, or something other than the mind itself. Anyway, something that you're focused on, focusing attention on. And so a stick or a stone, but Padmasambhava says, do that for a day. And then you move on, you know, so you get over that really quickly. And so the question then is, in our practice of focusing on a sign, does it matter which sign you take to as an object for developing shamatha? And I don't have to go into this in the detail that I have in the past or that I did with the nuns at Tosam Ling or a lot of the scholars also at Tosam Ling who were largely, because we were in Dharamsala and, you know, it's the hotbed of, you know, this is the home of the Dalai Lama and there are just so many Gelugpas around there, that really had to go into this again to point out that it isn't just Nyingmas that say focus on the breath, or it's not just Theravadins that say focus on the breath. It was the Buddha also. It was Lama Tsongkhapa, Pabangka Rinpoche, you know, all the Gelugpas, Asanga of Mahayana also, says focus on the breath, you know, and the reason, so they lay out different possibilities for objects that you could focus on, and they all say that if the discursive mind, or let's just, we could say, you know, in our familiar terms, rumination, but just that chattering mind is the biggest obstacle. What is it that is obscuring the natural state of the mind right now? If it is just that chattering mind that won't shut up, sound familiar? then if that's it, focus on the breath. And Lama Tsongkhapa, in sections that I think, yeah, I did edit that out, says you must, if discursive mind is your biggest obstacle, you must use the mind focused on, or attention focused on the breath. So, you know, you can't really say that the breath is an impure. Well, you can't. There are reasons that you could say that, but basically, that it's not the best thing to focus your shamatha practice on, as a focus on as this first element of shamatha focused on science. So it has, as you all know now, you have the great thing about the breath is that it is constant enough. So something like a stick or stone, it has that attribute of being constant. And so your introspection can check in to see if you're still on the object or not and get a very simple answer. Is it the breath or is it not? So then you know whether you're still on your object or not. Is it a stick or is it not? You know whether your mind is distracted or not. So it has that attribute. But that can really lead to boredom very quickly. And your mind then is going off seeking novel stimulus because it just requires discipline to just be content with a stick or a stone. You know, you have to really force yourself to be, you know, it's like you're doing isometric exercise, you know. And so the attribute of the breath that makes it such a good choice is that it is also changing. It is living, it is dynamic. The beginning of the breath is different than the end. The in-breath is different than the out-breath. Every breath is different. And so you have an opportunity because of this changing living quality then to really discover what is this breath and what is this breath, because it's different than the previous breath or will be different than the next breath. And so that really keeps you engaged. So that supports clarity. You know, it keeps you interested in this because these tactile sensations of the breath can be absolutely fascinating. So we're going to use the breath today. We're going to be working with the breath. We're choosing one full day of our march towards non-conceptualization, pristine awareness, and resting in pristine awareness to focus on breath meditation. So is there a way that we can do that will really prepare us well for our what's coming tomorrow, which is going to be really immersion in the four modes of mindfulness? And so what we are not going to do is take the first couple of years of shamatha training, which is shamatha focused attention focused on the breath. So attention is selective, exclusive, and focused on a particular object. And this leads to definitions of mindfulness, such as mindfulness is your present moment attention focused on an object of your choice without forgetting. So that makes, you know, that definition of mindfulness is describing breath meditation using attention, right? We're not going to do that. And that really doesn't describe, that definition of mindfulness really doesn't describe the four modes of mindfulness. You know what it seems to me. So it's really, luckily there are other descriptions of mindfulness also in the texts. But what we're going to be doing is using awareness of the breath rather than attention focused on the breath right away to just bring us right into this, to prime ourselves for the four modes of mindfulness, which doesn't use attention at all. You don't, you know, if the word attention comes up, it basically is referring to awareness in the four modes of mindfulness. You know, you can just tell from the context. It's not selective, exclusive, focused on a particular object without forgetting. It's not that at all. But we'll go into what it is tomorrow. But what we're going to do then is cultivate samadhi with using awareness. And what we're going to do then is to make, in Lama Tsongkhapa's terms, make the mind serviceable by cultivating three balances of the mind. So you could say that a mind that is so uncontent or dissatisfied with stillness that it would seek to shock itself is a symptom of an unbalanced mind. And what we're going to do is to balance the mind, use these three modes of shamatha practice, of focused on a sign, focused on conceptualization, focused on or settled in non-conceptualization, to make the mind serviceable by these three balances. So the first is that we are going to balance relaxation and clarity. So you know what the important, so I'll just list these three first. Relaxation and clarity, then we are going to add stability and balance stability and relaxation. So we're going to then have, first of all, the clarity, and then we are going to add vividness to the mix without losing stability. So then we are going to basically have vividness and stability in this perfect balance and harmony, and that leads to single-pointedness. And so the first of these, you know, is relaxation. And so it is so important to, in this approach, to first establish the base of relaxation, get relaxed. And so we bring in to retreat a body and mind that is agitated, that is tense, that is used to being in motion. So we have to relax. And especially in the urban environments that we live in, with all of their demands, we might need some remedial work. So just relaxing. Take that as a prerequisite for your meditation practice, and don't feel like you are skipping out, by dedicating time to do remedial work on relaxation. Yoga nidra, massage, meditation, should be all very relaxing experiences. So you establish the base of relaxation, but the important point is that alone is not sufficient. The first balancing act is balancing clarity with that relaxation, because we associate deep relaxation with falling asleep and drowsiness. So that is not meditation. So some of you still when you meditate, you fall asleep. There was snoring in the room this morning. And some people have never gotten past this first balancing act. So it really limits the possibilities of what you can achieve in meditation, because you haven't really even, if your mind automatically becomes drowsy as soon as you begin to relax and when you're meditating, you have just capped what you can possibly achieve in meditation. And you're not even, it's not a meditative state. So the meditative state is an anomalous state that is very similar to what positive psychologists call the flow state, which is it's this anomalous state of being simultaneously deeply relaxed and brilliantly clear. And so this is, performers want to be in this state. When the game is on the line and you're at the free throw line, this is the state that you want to be in. You don't want to be either falling asleep or distracted. You want to be present, relaxed, and brilliantly clear. So this is the first balancing act. And so there are ways that we do that. But then without that, you're not meditating. So this is the foundation of all meditation practice, this anomalous state of deep relaxation and clarity of mind. And then we are going to add, when it is appropriate, add stability. And I think there are traditions of meditation that, from this view, would really fall off the cliff of this. focusing on stability too early. So you shouldn't even concern yourself with stability until you have this first balancing act down of relaxation and clarity. And then you concern yourself with stability when it is appropriate, just as a mother doesn't scold her, or a father doesn't scold their two-year-old or infant when they're distressed and crying. You know, it's cooing and, you know, just comforting. You know, so you're soothing this mind to get it to relax and be clear. But then at some point, you know, as Ellie gets older, he might be at this point now, you realize that time, you know, for a child to really grow into a person, they need to be guided and to have, well, let's just say discipline or a program, to learn, you know, what's acceptable, what's not acceptable, and etc. And so at that point then, what's acceptable, what we are hoping for is stability. And so we add, when it's appropriate, we add stability to the mix. And when is it appropriate? Well, it's appropriate when you can add stability without losing your relaxation. So this means without striving, without obsessing about it, and without beating yourself up when your mind is distracted. Because then you're just being, it's too early. Go back to relaxation and clarity. You know, and so when relaxation is solid and the clarity is solid so that your mind is bright and relaxed, then you focus on stability. And then thirdly, the third balancing act is vividness. And this is comes into the discussion of the 9 stages of shamatha later, after you've already basically your mind is no longer distracted, or by coarse distraction anyway. So then you begin to concern yourself with vividness as an antidote to the laxities, which range from coarse to medium to subtle. But the antidote for medium laxity, beginning with medium laxity, is vividness. And so what you want to be doing here then is adding vividness to this mix, to the balances you've already achieved, without it disrupting stability. So you won't concern yourself with vividness until your stability is solid, and then you put them all together, and then you have this perfect balance of single-pointedness that is free of laxity and free of distraction. So there are 2 important ingredients of stability, and this is why, you know, going to the desert island of long retreat, the Lam Rim Chenmo would be a good book to take along. Or if you really only had to take one book, you know, the 3rd volume might do it. So this is from the 3rd volume of the Lam Rim Chenmo, which Alan translated this for the Lam Rim Chenmo Translation Committee. He translated large parts of the 3rd volume. So Lama Tsongkhapa says, the concentration that you will accomplish here has 2 special features. Vivid intensity, and intense mental clarity. So vivid intensity, parentheses, and intense mental clarity, and non-discursive stability, that is staying one-pointedly on the object of meditation. So you have vividness and stability. Some add bliss to these, making 3 features. So you could say non-conceptuality, luminosity, and bliss. Since the development of this sort of vivid intensity is blocked as long as there is laxity, while one-pointed non-discursiveness is blocked as long as there is excitement, laxity and excitement are the chief obstacles to achieving genuine concentration. So there you have it, the 2 ditches of excitation or distraction in the left ditch, dullness or laxity in the right ditch. And we're trying to steer between these two and stay on the road of mindfulness. So most of the definitions or most of our techniques, as we talked about, of developing shamatha, and certainly it's a technique that we've used also and that Alan has taught. tried to remember, when is the last time that I actually heard Lama Alan teach attention focused on the breath, say at the nose? I don't know, it's a long time now, maybe 3 years, something like that. But again, I was just, you know, I got the latest iteration of him teaching this at Tushita in December, and, you know, it was straight to what we're going to be doing. So that, you know, so, but it's interesting to think that most approaches to shamatha we're not even concerning ourselves with now. But it's helpful. So I still love breath meditation focused on the nose, for instance, because it's very effective. So it doesn't mean that you throw it out or you've outgrown it. You know, you just use it when the circumstance is right, but we don't have time in this retreat. So I definitely went through it in the two-month retreat. You know, we spent, God, I don't know, a couple weeks, you know, on breath meditation. You know, it's delicious having that amount of time. But we don't have that time here, so we're going straight, cutting straight to awareness of, well, Asanga's mindfulness of breathing. So that attention, which is selective, exclusive, focused on an object that you choose to select, you choose. So this is the important thing with breath meditation and attention. There are two important elements there. First of all is choosing an object to direct your attention to. And so many people will sit down to meditate and never choose an object to meditate on. They just kind of let it come, you know, let it flow. You know, and if you're doing breath meditation, you can't do that. You have to choose an object and then you direct your attention to that. That's stage one of shamatha, directed attention. You direct your attention to a chosen object, and then the second part of experience of training is you train to sustain where you have directed your attention. So that leads to then a definition, and this is a definition that Alan used in the earlier days. Basically, mindfulness is your present moment attention directed to an object of your choice without forgetting. So that makes perfect sense. But here is, for instance, another definition of mindfulness from among, you know, a handful that Alan used at Tushita. And this is from Buddhaghosa, who is, you know, the great Pali commentator in the Theravadin tradition. By means of mindfulness, they, that is, other mental processes, remember, or it itself remembers, or it is simply just remembering. Thus, it is mindfulness. So this leads to that definition of mindfulness as recollection. And Alan often tries to, or translates that as bearing in mind. So you are bearing in something, you are bearing in mind. But here's where it seems then, I like, this is really an important addition to this definition of mindfulness, of recollection. Its characteristic is not floating. Its property is not losing. Its manifestation is guarding, or the state of being face to face with an object. And this seems to be equally applicable to me to awareness as well as to attention. You know, especially this manifestation of being face to face with an object. So this is what our awareness is doing. It's bringing us face to face, the awareness illuminates an object. And so we are brought face to face with what awareness has illuminated. And it is not floating. It is still. So Asanga's mindfulness of breathing, which is where we are going to start with our breath meditation practice now, uses awareness rather than attention. So attention being selective, exclusive, and focused, and awareness being open, global, receptive. And I've talked about that distinction a lot in the past, so I won't go into it in more detail now, but they are really two distinctly different ways of engaging or knowing the world. The critical thing to know about attention is that it is always, to me, and I think this is, I could defend this, is that it is conceptual in nature. And it is because what you are doing is plucking out of the myriad possibilities of things that you could attend to, the living context of everything in this room, you're plucking one thing out of all of that to look at in great detail, selective, exclusive, and focused attention. And so the process of plucking that out with attention is abstracting. You abstract out of the living context of the whole thing, one thing to focus on. So does that one thing actually exist as anything other than an abstraction? But the power of that is because it is an abstraction, a conceptualization, it is explicit rather than implicit. It can be precisely known. You can give it a dictionary definition. You can compare this with everything else that you know. And you can communicate it to other people. And so it has great power. This is what builds societies and cultures. And, the Kangyur and Tengyur as well. So it's because of this abstraction, the conceptualization of experience, non-conceptual experience, that we have Dujam Lingpa's description of what that experience is like. So Asanga, then, in his text, Shravaka Bhumi, so like the Buddha, Asanga teaches in the Shravaka Bhumi mindfulness through 16 phases. Mindfulness of the breath, that is, through 16 phases that culminates with arhatship. And so Buddhaghosa also, the Buddha teaches these but doesn't really do a commentary on them. And then the big commentary in the Pali Canon is, or of the Pali commentators, is Buddhaghosa in his Path of Purification. And so there's this difference in the third of these 16 stages between Asanga and Buddhaghosa. So in the interpretation of attending to the whole body of the breath, I breathe in and out. So Buddhaghosa took that to mean, so the Theravadin took that to mean that the whole body of the breath is the full course of the inhalation and the exhalation. So this is, we attend to that with attention also. The tactile sensations of the full course of the inhalation and exhalation. So that's the way that Buddhaghosa interpreted the Buddha's statement with the whole attending to the whole body of the breath. I breathe in and out. So Asanga, who is in the Mahayana tradition, took that to mean attending to the whole field of the body. So, attending to the whole body of the breath, meaning that the breath, however it expresses itself, in the whole body. So can you do that with attention? You're just open and receptively aware of sensations. So these are still tactile sensations of the breath, but wherever they occur. So you're not looking in, you're not saying, what is my experience of the breath at the nose? But what is my experience of the breath wherever it occurs in the body? So this leads you to an experience of awareness as if it is filling the entire body, So it's as if the entire space of the body is aware and is just becoming aware of a selected field of experience, so which is tactile sensations of the breath. And we're going to, in our meditation, narrow our way down there, move our way down to that selective field. And then one of the other elements about this that is really helpful also in preparing us for later practice. So we're working with the breath and all of that, the benefits, because what we're doing is when we are, here is the fundamental reason that the masters say that if discursive mind is what is obscuring substrate consciousness from you, that the two can't operate at the same time. Tactile sensations and the chattering discursive mind or the conceptual mind can't operate at the same time. So all of the five senses of the primary consciousnesses, so if we had more time, we would go into the 52 mental factors. But so there are six primary consciousnesses, the five sense consciousnesses, and then mental consciousness. And so all of the five sense consciousnesses are non-conceptual. And the mental consciousness is highly conceptual. So if we are the body, our awareness or attention focused on tactile sensations or sound, or this one is a lot more difficult, sight, visual stimulation, because that one is so heavily conceptual. But sound is easier, tactile sensations are easier. Taste is, or smell especially, is so associated with memory. So sound and tactile sensations especially present real opportunities for as a refuge from conceptualization. And so, and this is the neuroscience and cognitive science show the same thing. That is, when you're focused on the five senses, the wandering mind, what's called the default wandering mind, goes dim. So there's this exclusion. You know, you're either one or the other. And so this is why the great benefit of focusing on tactile or engaging tactile sensations of the breath, because it is a refuge from conceptualization. And to the degree then that you are able to do that, the conceptual mind goes dormant. And then I'll just finish this up before we take a break, and then we'll take a break and then come back and do the meditation. So sorry I'm going on longer. Usually I try to keep this at 54 minutes or an hour and then take a break and then do the meditation. But you know, sometimes, especially in the front loading here or the preliminaries, you know, but it's taking a little longer. So in our approach to Asanga's mindfulness of breathing then, which is dealing with awareness rather than attention, there are still what we're going to be doing, using some techniques that are in common with your familiar breath meditation and attention. So the first of those is that there are four postures available to you. So these are important because relaxation is so important. And especially, so you choose, the four postures are first, and you could say that these are arrayed on a continuum from relaxation to clarity. So the first, the most relaxed, is Shavasana. So for a lot of people coming into this tradition and hearing that meditating in Shavasana is okay is really a surprise and a relief and all of that. But not only is it okay, you have to. It's not that you have to right now in this session meditate in Shavasana, but you have to learn to master Shavasana without falling asleep. And because that is going to be the ultimate proof that you have mastered this balance of relaxation and clarity. Because in the later practices where we're really dealing with awareness with no object, Shavasana can be just the most relaxed, spacious position that you can be in. And so you have to master that relaxation and clarity. So, but don't do it if it's not, if you're not ready for it yet. Or in this particular session that you're not, that it's not a good idea. So you have Shavasana, and then the seated position, which is either seated on a cushion or in a chair. The important thing is to keep your spine erect. So if you're either seated position or in a chair, if your shoulders are slumping, I can tell right away you're, you know, a moment away from falling out of your chair or snoring. You know, because so you need to, and here for both of these positions, what is really helpful, Lama Ellen has talked about feeling like you have a string on your sternum and that's pulling you up. And I notice that if I have a string on my sternum and it's pulling up, I feel a little compression in my lower back. And so what has come to my mind, what I do, is something that Mirashani taught me years ago when I was having shoulder problems, and she said, your alignment is the problem, stupid. So Mira is Jarrett's wife and one of my very favorite yoga teachers of all time, because she nailed it. And so this, you know, what she pointed out to me is that you raise your shoulders to your ears, then bring your shoulders back, and then let your shoulders slide down your shoulder blades. And what does that feel like? It feels like a string pulling my sternum. I feel like my heart is just open. So I have gotten into the habit of when I sit down, I adjust my alignment, and then hopefully, you know, it stays there as long as, you know, without slumping. And so you can do this in a chair also. And that really, then you notice a surge of energy. And so we're going to be talking about introspection in a little breakout session later in the afternoon. But when you notice that your mind is feeling lax, your posture is the first thing to check. And one of the things that you can do is just notice that your shoulders are slumping, and then just sit erect, and then just, whoa, feel the voltage, you know, because it is, will take care of a lot of laxity. So you have the four postures, the seated position, and then related also to, because we're moving towards clarity, and so you're choosing your position to meditate in based on what this session of meditation needs right now, your mind. Is it relaxation because your mind is really distracted? So in that case, choose Shavasana if your mind is really distracted and you have a lot of energy. And so there's no possibility you're going to fall asleep. Then choose Shavasana to relax. But if you're feeling drowsy, then choose one of these postures that are going to support more clarity. And so moving towards more clarity is the standing posture. So this is one I have never heard Alan teach, and I have never seen anybody in one of Alan's retreats use it. Oh, is that right? Probably one of my, somebody who's come through me, right? Well, you don't have to answer. But, so anyway, this is the neglected treasure as an antidote to laxity. And people who do it, who have been, you know, have never been able to get past laxity, stand up. And basically you're in Tadasana, mountain pose. You know, your feet are just balanced and relaxed, you know, fore and aft. And, you know, so it can be helpful to, so you probably want to keep your eyes open for if you're having problems balancing with your eyes closed. But we're, you know, all of our meditation this weekend is going to be with eyes open anyway. But you can, if it feels distracting to look out into the room, or, you know, looking outside, for instance, on this view out here is really, really good for clarity. You know, so if you're feeling drowsy after the third ghataka, you know, that we're ganging together, then you can just stand up and look outside at this bright view, and that will definitely brighten up your attention. So you have that, and then walking meditation, which we're not going to get into because we don't really have time, and it's kind of outside the scope. But in more time, walking meditation is really good also, so that you're never not going to fall asleep in walking meditation. And then the labyrinths that they have around here would be wonderful for walking meditation if they're not muddy. So you choose then which position to meditate in based on what you need right now. And so there is I'm going to keep referring to the natural state of the body, speech, and mind. You know, this is standard Padmasambhava preliminary to our meditation. So the natural state of the body is relaxed ease, stillness is the second feature. So that means that you don't fidget. So choose a position to meditate in that you can stay absolutely still in for 24 minutes. Because so if you're fidgeting and moving, that means that your mind is fidgeting also. And so watch the impulse to move. Unless, you know, a limb is going to sleep or something like that, or, you know, you have a really good reason. But most movement is not, there's no good reason for it. It's this, touching your face. I meditate with my eyes open, so I see everything that you guys are doing. You can tell when somebody's mind, yeah, they have a fart, you know, in their brain, you know, and because they will touch their face, you know, or just, you know, scratch, you know. So the interesting thing is to watch the impulse to move without moving, you know, just watch that as a mental appearance, and then just remain still. And the value of that is not only for yourself, but it's for everyone else around you. Because if we're able to pull this off as a group, we have to remain still. Because the person behind you is meditating with their eyes open. And you can totally forget about the visual field with your eyes open until there's movement. And then you can't help but be distracted by it. So remain still in the natural state of the body. And then the third quality of the natural state of the body is this alert, vigilant attention. And vigilant, then, you can think of to be alert, but also vigilant always connotes introspection. So the benefit of the group meditation then has been a surprise to me ever since starting to lead group retreats, because I always, most of my experience, I had never had good experience in group meditation or group retreats before as meditative experience, but always solitary. But these retreats, I really like the group experience, you know, and it seems that you, in your room, you do just scratch and shift your position, you know, without consequence. But here, you've got responsibilities, you know. And it just feels like there, and then later, you can feel the whole group just kind of, you know, as you become more and more stable, the whole group just kind of gets this vibe of stability, and it really is supportive of the group. So there is real benefit in group practice. And so, you know, in these group sessions, I plan to be here. The silent sessions, I sit here and I just start the timer, you know. But I like to be here because I like to be part of the group. But there are some hazards in group meditation also. So one is movement, you know, where it's the group, you can distract the group. One person being fidgety can really distract, you know, all the people around them. Another one, and this one, you know, is even more broadcast wider, is snoring. Noise. So if you have to deal with your laxity, not only for your own meditation, but for others as well. So if you're snoring, if you're falling asleep, you know, this is a problem for the whole room. So if you if somebody next to you is snoring, so here's the rule. Don't go off and do Shavasana alone, you know, where you can disrupt the whole room. Oh, you always have to have a buddy near you that within reaching distance that can reach over and touch you, because I don't have a squirt gun here, you know, that will reach the back of the room. So if somebody next to you is snoring, then just reach over and, you know, touch them. And then the important thing is, if you have been touched and you come back into consciousness, don't get indignant and say, "I was not snoring. I was breathing deeply. That's relaxed." You know, so just be grateful that somebody has brought you back from the brink or from beyond coarse dullness. And then, again, just to reiterate what Mary Kay was talking about yesterday as part of group practice, be on time. You know, so our sessions are going to start on, you know, when I, you know, on schedule, except when we're off schedule. But, you know, I'll always tell you when we come back, when we're coming back, and when we're going to start. So don't be wandering in late. And because the doors are going to be closed, and then, so don't knock on the door. And then just one last, couple more things. So the gate, one of the benefits of meditating with your eyes open also is you can use the level of your gaze to as antidotes to laxity and excitation. So if your eyes are closed and your shoulders are slumped, you're a goner. If your posture is erect and your eyes are open, you know, you're in the game. So you can then, if you notice laxity with your eyes are open, and you notice that so the important thing about antidotes to laxity or dullness is notice them as soon as they show up, and don't wait until you're falling asleep. So if you notice when you're just not vividly engaged with your object, then the antidote that you have to supply is much more subtle. And so one of the very subtle antidotes, so a fairly coarse antidote, is your posture. You know, if you're beginning to really get dull, change your posture. That's pretty coarse. But a very subtle one is to elevate your gaze. And this will shock you how effective it is. A difference of a few degrees on the horizon will be the difference between distraction and falling asleep. So you find the sweet spot. If your eyes are, you know, falling really downcast and you're feeling lax, elevate them. And then you'll find a point where if you elevate them too much, you're distracted. So then you lower them. If your eyes are distracted, usually what's happening is you're off in one of your favorite quadrants, upper left or upper right, depending on which hemisphere dominant you are. But your eyes will be darting back and forth, but they'll be elevated. And so lower your gaze then. And as you lower your gaze, it remains more stable and stops darting as well. So your gaze with your eyes open can be really a very fine-tuning for your antidotes to distraction and excitation. And then the last thing is just to recognize that your mind is going to wander. And because, for a time anyway. Well, it is. So, and the interesting to note that you can't, when you're distracted, you can't will the end of the wandering because you don't even know that you're wandering. So the disengagement from the wandering is spontaneous. It just happens. So you can't will it, but you can begin to influence it. So the way that you train the mind to, because there's an unconscious weighing process that is going on, and you can't control it consciously, but you can begin to train it and influence it. And the way that you train to disengage more quickly, to be gone for briefer periods of time, and to disengage more quickly when you're wandering, is with the four R's. So the four R's, again, are to, first of all, release your grasp on the distracting object. So these are different than, a little different order. They're based on Allen's three R's, but they're a little bit different. So, you know, just know that. So the first of these is release your grasp. And this is, you know, based on my own experience, I can often go back into wandering without fully releasing. So I recognize that I'm wandering, but it's as if waking up from a dream in the morning, and you don't fully wake up and you go back into the dream. So wake up fully. So release your grasp on the distracting object, and then the grasp on the distracting object will mean more to you when we get into the four modes of mindfulness. But then the second one is the one that people really appreciate, and this one is really powerful. That's rejoice. And so you're not rejoicing that you've been distracted, you're rejoicing that you are now lucid again. And so in this moment, what you're doing is you're recognizing the difference between this present moment of lucidity that you've just recovered and the previous moments of non-lucidity. It's night and day, and you have never paused to really recognize the difference before. And in that familiarization is the power of the training of the disengagement, because you are in the moment the rejoicing is a moment of sukha, of pleasure, and you want to just feel how enjoyable, how good this lucidity feels. And let's just say, in my folk psychology approach, it would be like you're getting a shot of dopamine, you know, just reward pleasure, the pleasure center. And so you're then training the mind that this is basically, because it's pleasurable, it's important. So lucidity is important. Recognize whenever I am going non-lucid. So that's the second element then, or the second R. So release, rejoice, and then return. So that requires that you recollect, you know, what is my chosen object? You return to your chosen object. And then the fourth R is, on the full course of the exhalation, you relax ever more deeply through the full course of the exhalation. So it's by doing the release, rejoice, return, and relax, you are training yourself in your response to discovering, when you spontaneously disengage, you are training yourself to disengage more and more quickly. And there are reasons in the mind for that, but we don't have to go into that. So let's take a break, and let's make that a 10-minute break, and come back at, let's just say 10:48, and we will then go right into meditation.